If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
The Sound Podcast is part of the OSIRIS Network. OSIRIS is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. We'll be doing many live events this summer around the country, which will include artist interviews, contests, and more. Sign up for our newsletter at OSIRISpod.com to stay in the loop. Relics Magazine is a media partner of OSIRIS. For more, visit relics.com. The show starts now.
Hey, this is Scott Sherrard here, and you're listening to The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Invitation. I know where I belong. I don't need no confirmation. I've been knowing you much too long. Your love is like no other. It sure enough satisfies me. Baby, you keep me humming. You're everything a good man needs. Well, I need you to soothe me in the morning. Rock me through the night. Soothe me in the morning. And rock me through the night. You know the way she puts it on me. It sets my mood just right. Take one more ride. It's a whole lot better if you open up your eyes. You got to give me, give me, give me, give me, give me one more try. You know my love was sure, sure to satisfy. Come meet me in Tennessee. Yeah, babe. You know I'll fly you in from Dallas. Come and meet me in Tennessee. You know your love, it keeps me running. Baby, you're everything a good man. Love, it keeps me humming. You're a young child driving me wild. Baby, I ain't funny. You're everything a good man needs. Well,
You've been listening to Everything a Good Man Needs, featuring Taj Mahal on vocals, off of Scott Sherrard's forthcoming record, Saving Grace. Since 2008, Scott has been the lead guitar player and de facto musical director for the Greg Allman Band, occasionally lending vocals to the songs he wrote, like Love Like Kerosene, that would find their way into Greg's sets, or other songs he brought to the table. In fact, Scott and Greg co-wrote My Only True Friend off of Greg's last record, Southern Blood. Since Greg's unfortunate passing, Scott has found himself at a crossroads between hanging on to his love and work with Greg and getting on with his own career. Luckily for us, he will be releasing his first solo record in quite some time, but his fifth thus far, September 21st, Saving Grace, and I can tell you it's a gorgeous blues, soul, and R&B record with standout slide guitar playing and passionate vocals. We recently sat down with Scott to talk about Saving Grace and his post-Greg Allman life. Our conversation started, though, when I asked Scott about the days following Greg's passing.
Well, I mean, you know, I spent close to a decade working with Greg. You know, I joined his band in summer of 2008. And we hit the road in the late fall that year and kind of, you know, never looked back. Even with all his health struggles, because he had a few major health struggles when I was with him, you never really believed that he was going to succumb to anything, because you spend 9 years on the road and you just, you know, you start to just figure, he always works it out. And, you know, really what ended up happening is this last illness he had, really directly affected his voice, which was this recurrence of liver cancer, and it was pressing on a nerve that was affecting his ability to sing. And when I saw that happen, I thought, well, you know, I'm not sure if he's going to make it out of this. And he spent several months at home trying everything he could. I mean, he wanted to perform so badly. You know, all the way to the end, and we just couldn't get him over the line health-wise. So I went down and I spent a couple days at his house a couple weeks before he actually passed away. And we spent some time together that was really it was really, really special, because I think we were in the trenches all those years, touring all over and working on getting his records done and writing and having a great time, but never really, you know, dealing with the fact that, you know, this was going to get him eventually. And that's what happened. I think we wrapped it up as well as you can. You know, there's definitely a grieving process I'm still in, and we're all still in, who were friends with him and lived with him for so long, you know.
But there you are, kind of at a crossroads, right? I mean, between hanging on to the legacy of the music you made with Greg and the memories that you have with Greg, and sort of, you know, from a practical sort of standpoint, needing to get on with your life and your own career at that point, right? I mean, that's kind of where you were.
Well, I mean, I moved to New York City in summer of 97. With my buddy Sean Dixon, and we had a band called the Chesterfields. We made two albums that I'm real proud of with that band. And then I went on to make four solo albums. I had three done and released when I joined Greg's band. I did the fourth one, the Brickyard Band record, while I was working with Greg. And this record, Saving Grace, that's coming out September 21st, this is my fifth solo album. And I definitely took a lot of time to work on it, because I had taken over as music director for Greg's band, and him and I were working really hard on on his band and on his last couple albums, which took my eyes off the ball. But all that to say, you know, I was a solo artist, a struggling solo artist,
right,
before I ever got the gig. And Saving Grace is it's a continuation of what I did before and during and after Greg. And I see my work, you know, on Back to Making Live, and particularly on Southern Blood. Southern Blood, I was, you know, a real active part of. You know, it was Don Was and Greg and I working together, and a lot of the album, you know, was conceived either with the three of us together or with Greg and I on the road. in terms of the content, the song choices, and the arrangements, and then, of course, brought to the band, who would finish them off with great horn arrangements and rhythm arrangements. But I see my work with Greg as kind of integrated into my own in that respect, because he always made us feel like band members he had the final say, but he always had an open floor.
Right.
And certainly creatively with writing together. I mean, we completed writing two songs together. He sang one of my songs, Love Like Kerosene, on the two albums we did, Back to Making Live and Southern Blood. He recorded that song twice. Mm-hmm. So I always felt, especially in the last few years of Greg's band, I felt creatively part of that. I don't feel like a traditional quote unquote sideman with my relationship to Greg. It got a lot deeper than that on both artistic and personal levels. So it was, when we lost Greg, it was like losing a band that I was part of. I don't see it as losing a job, you know?
Right. And I'm glad that you mentioned Southern Blood, because you also co-wrote My Only True Friend with Greg for that record, right? Grammy nominated. Well,
yep.
Southern Blood was Grammy nominated, but also that track for, I guess, top Americana song that year. So, it was this relationship that was quite close and, you know, probably would have continued for a lot longer and probably wouldn't have been able to perhaps make Saving Grace. I mean, it took you a long time. I remember talking to you the first time we chatted and, you know, you had been working on Saving Grace, but that was, you know, quite some time, and it's taken quite some time for Saving Grace to see the light of day. And so perhaps it would have taken even longer. So here's the thing about Saving Grace is, to say it's a traditional blues record or soul record or R&B record really doesn't do the album justice, because I think it is so many of those things and so much more in terms of the way all the songs come together and present themselves. What I find intriguing is that half the album was recorded with the high rhythm section and half with the boys from Muscle Shoals, David Hood and Spooner Oldham. How did you decide how to record each song with those two separate groups? Or was it just a matter of two different sessions and you got what you got during those two sessions?
Well, the whole thing was very deliberate, and I put the plan together with my manager and business partner, Jesse Guillermo, who really helped to make the whole thing a reality. I conceived it myself along with Scott Bomar, my co-producer, and also brought in my friend Charlie Martinez, who was the recording engineer and co-producer on it. It was a big idea. That was why I got so many of these guys on board to help with it. And basically, I had forged these relationships with these two legendary studio bands that had been huge influences on me growing up, and on everyone, really. I mean, they play on all these, you know, seminal records. And I got to know them during my time with Greg. Greg's drummer, Steve Potts, is a Memphis music royalty. And, you know, I think his first drum teacher was Al Jackson Jr. from Booker T and the MGs. And he's been playing with the high rhythm guys his whole life. So I've been knowing Steve for a long time, and he introduced me to these guys. And then we got Mark Franklin and Art Edmiston on horns in Greg's band a few years ago. And they also work with the high rhythm guys. And Scott Bomar, my co-producer, uses them in the studio. So that's how I got to know them, was through all those kind of tributaries that started with Steve Potts from Greg's band. The Muscle Shoals guys I met, they came to New York City and did a show around the release of the documentary that came out on them.
Right.
And that was a few years ago also. And Greg came in and did it, and I MD'd the show with David Hood and played. And we just had a blast. And when I went to make Saving Grace, and, you know, the plan was to make it in December of 2016, which we did, A few months out, I reached out to Scott Bomar, my co-producer, and I said, look, you know, I want to bring Charlie from New York down to engineer. I want to get these two bands. And luckily, Bomar knew all these guys also. Of course, he works with High Rhythm all the time, but he also knew the Swampers. So the two of us got to hold all the guys. We put together a schedule, and we spent 3 days in Muscle Shoals and 3 days in Memphis doing, you know, like a couple, you know, three songs a day, four songs a day with overdubs and everything. So we cut it live on the floor to tape. All my vocals on the record, except for the song Saving Grace, were done live on the floor with the rhythm section.
Right.
And the rhythm guitar. I did it live. So we had that real immediacy and the sonic quality of it being cut to tape. And I mean, that was basically 90% of the record. It was done in like the space of about 1 week. But that was December 2016. And then, of course, in 2017, we got, you know, the Greg Grammy nomination for my co-write on the song and the album. And then Greg passed away in May. And then we had to do things around that. And so we had the album finished, but we were sitting on it. And the last piece was during the Grammys, Taj Mahal had heard, thanks to Chank Middleton, Greg's friend, had heard a song that Greg and I wrote called Everything a Good Man Needs that
right.
didn't make it onto Southern Blood because we ran out of time to record it. And the last piece of the record was actually cut in New York City because Taj works so much, we couldn't really get him tied down, and we got him during the Grammy week. He had a day off, and we booked a studio in Harlem, and we were also lucky, pardon me, Bernard Purdy was in town that day too, the legendary session drummer. So I got Bernard on it, who's one of Greg's favorite drummers, and I didn't think this song was going to be on my record. Taj loved the song, but it didn't fit with his album cycle, and he really wanted to do it, and I felt very lucky for that. And, you know, he was basically like, look, man, put it on your record, you know. It's the only track I've ever put on my own record that I didn't sing, but I wanted to do it as a tribute to Greg, and I wanted to get, you know, Taj is definitely his favorite living singer at this point. So that made it on there. So there's one song that was cut in New York City, although the horns were overdubbed in Memphis on that song. So there, we have a little bit of flavor there. That's kind of, you know, like Atlantic Records style. So I like to think of that.
Atlantic Records style, but in 2018, where you could send a Pro Tools session or bounce a session anywhere in the world that you want very quickly. Everything a Good Man Needs is an interesting song. It's co-written with Greg Allman, and it is a phrase, I think, from what I've read, that Greg used to say to you when you used to pull into a new town on tour, right? Tell us a little bit about how Everything a Good Man Needs came together.
Yeah, well, you know, we would always ride on the same bus. I mean, he would have the back lounge and the rhythm section would ride with him. So as I was saying earlier, I mean, I did that with him from 2008 until he stopped performing, in 2017. So, you know, basically he would always hang out, with the band, and we would have a lot of fun. And, he had a lot of different sayings. You know, Greg really believed in the power of words. You know, he never wasted his breath, and he could do that in a way that was really meaningful and deep, and he could do it in a way that was hilarious. And you know, he just had this thing he would say. You know, I specifically remember we pulled into a casino one night at like 4 a.m. and we were rolling out of the bus to get in our hotel rooms. He was going to gamble instead of going to bed. I said, Greg, why do you do it now? He's like, yeah, nobody bothers me now. And like the dealers are tired. This is a good time to go in and roll. You know, he was a great gambler, man. He used to clean up. And he said, you know, this place, he said, oh, I know this place. It's got everything a good man needs. And I said, that's a great title for a song. And he's like, well, let's write it. So, but yeah, it was something I would hear him say now and then. And I remember that particular time. And that started off that song, you know.
There are so many great songs on this record, and you know, you've always been an incredible player, but one of the things that I picked out from this record over some of your solo material is your vocal performances on this record are very strong. Whether you're singing the blues or on more soulful tunes like Angeline. Is that something that you've been working on? I mean, you did sing a bit with Greg's band, and you have been known to sing, obviously, as a solo musician, but really, the vocals really cut through on this record. Is that something that you've been spending a lot of time with?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fronting bands for, you know, my own bands, and originally the Chesterfields, for like 20 years. Right. Interestingly, it's, you know, with the guitar, singing, writing thing, and then I also produce, and you know, so it can get confusing. But you know, people definitely know me better as a guitar player because of my visibility with Greg. But
right.
around New York, I mean, there were a lot of people who even, you know, saw me more as a singer back in the day. So I've always tried to kind of approach them equally, you know, and see how it shakes out. And I'm happy for it to shake out either way. I see it all as like, you know, making music and delivering song is what it's all about when you're singing. You know, really making that marriage is what I'm trying to say between the music and the lyric. So, you know, I've always put my all into it, and I've even studied voice formally and stuff just for stamina and technique and stuff at one time. So I'm very serious about it, and I always have been. And, you know, Greg was very supportive of me as a singer. That's why we used to sing Soul Shine together on the gig quite often. And, you know, he would come to some of my gigs and hang out, and he was always very supportive of my writing and singing. And I think when I was making Saving Grace, this album, you know, when you're, as I told you before, I mean, every song except for the title track I cut live on the floor with no overdubs. So those vocal performances you're hearing are the exact length of the song live with the rhythm section. And I was, you know, I've produced enough other artists, and I've worked with enough legacy artists like, you know, Greg or Lee Von Helm, you know, people who are rock legends, even going back to my childhood, being around guys like, you know, Hubert Sumlin or Pine Top Perkins, Buddy Miles. I mean, these guys, you know, they're not guys who did a lot of takes. I mean, that Greg Allman Southern Blood record, I mean, those are almost all first or second vocal takes all the way through you're listening to on that record.
Right.
And I mean, back to Making Live, the other record I did with him, that is one show, one time through. There were no do-overs. You know, the label didn't give us any money to tape multiple shows. They just came down and did one show and left. And I mean, that's some of the best singing of his career on that. And I think as a singer, I was watching that, and I did my Brickyard Band album. I sang most of the vocals live on that on the floor, and I really liked the results.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went in to do Saving Grace, when you're looking through the glass and it's, you know, Howard Grimes on drums, you know, or David Hood on bass, and you got all these guys coming through your cans, and you're in, you know, when we were at Fame and Muscle Shoals, you know, you're in this room where, you know, not only were all these amazing legendary records that changed all our lives made there,
right,
but I had just made Southern Blood with Greg there that same year. So I had that experience was fresh, and I was standing in that booth at Fame where Greg had stood to give his last performance. And trust me, I was getting chills just thinking about that. even though he was still on the earth at the time, you know, I knew he wasn't going to perform anymore. And there was a lot of the weight of history weighed down very heavy on this record, because this is the record I've been trying to make for 20 years in some respects. But the reason I got all these guys on this record is because all these guys are 70 years old. And I had met all of them, and I'd fallen in love with all of them as people. I fell in love with them as musicians when I was a kid. But I fell in love with all these musicians as people. And I said, including Greg Allman, by the way. And I said, you know what? This record, I'm going to get these guys while I still can. Because, you know, even adding Everything a Good Man Needs, the song Greg and I wrote, to me, it was like I wanted to have a piece of his artistry on the record, too. You know, this record is really a turning the page moment for me. And an homage, really, to my entire life of playing music and meeting these guys, and then taking my original music and filtering it through them. And the vibe in the studio was just electric. You know, we were just all just having a ball. cracking each other up. It was an amazing spiritual experience for me, and I think it was a great day at work for those guys. All that goes into getting the vocal performance that's in the moment and captures the song. And I did feel very like I got very lucky on this record on many levels with that.
Yeah, it's absolutely outstanding. I mean, the performances are outstanding. One of the themes that comes through is love between probably man and woman, husband and wife, girlfriend and boyfriend. Are these, when you're writing songs, are you thinking about your own personal situations, or are you thinking about, you know, love and these relationships in a more general kind of way? Because you sing with such passion about them, and obviously the lyrics are so strong. I mean, Angeline is hilarious, but about a ball breaker for sure. but that's, you know, that's one of the things that comes through, is this theme of love between man and woman, or partners is maybe a better word to describe it. Is that something that you're conscious of? Are you trying to write love songs, or are you just trying to write really great songs?
I mean, with writing, like, I don't really, unless I'm collaborating with somebody actively, writing my own music for my own records is a really stream of consciousness kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There's a thing I say, and I'm sure I didn't make it up. I probably heard it somewhere at some point, but, all great songs are basically like, love me mommy, love me baby, or love me to the world.
You know? Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, you know, you're trying to get someone's attention when you're playing music, because you're trying to pull them into telling them a story. And the most powerful stories are the universal ones to me. I mean, there are people, you get one or two people every generation, like a Bob Dylan. You know, I don't even know if there's going to be, actually, we've only got one Bob Dylan. I don't know if there was ever a lyricist like him before or after who can equal him in terms of the fact that he could write poetry and it became rock and roll. I think there's a lot of other writers that try to do that. And mm-hmm. I think that what ends up usually happening is the music suffers. My biggest influences for songwriting are guys like, you know, if you go way back and you start with like the Brill Building guys, right. You know, and you go through to like Percy Mayfield, and then of course Chuck Berry, and for me it goes through those guys to obviously the English rock, and really into, you know, a lot of the staff writers at the R&B labels, you know, guys like Don Bryant, who wrote for the Five Royales and Stax, Isaac Hayes, and David Porter, who wrote for Stax, Smokey Robinson, you know, all the writers at Motown. Stevie Wonder is a massive songwriting influence for me. And my favorite musician of all time is Jimi Hendrix. I mean, he's my all-around number one, because to me, he has so many genius qualities as a musician. But as a songwriter, he's also one of my biggest influences because of how he pushed the bounds of all his influences into something new. But the through line with most of these people, maybe Jimmy accepted for his psychedelic forays, and you know, but really the best songs by all these guys are very, very simple lyrically.
Right.
And they do revolve around sort of universal themes most of the time, or one of those three interactions, you know, your past, you know, your loves, you know, in terms of your romantic love and struggle, and then your struggle with the world. And I mean, that's really all we're writing about, I think. Like I said, if you're Dylan and you can take it to the level of like, you know, poet, you know,
right.
But I've never kidded myself. I mean, as I'm a literary geek, and I was one of those AP English kids, I never even got to calculus. I was a disaster with science and math, but when it came to the written word, I was obsessed. And I still write. I do a lot of essays and things on the side mainly concerning music, of course, and my career and teaching, you know, music and stuff. But that's a big passion of mine. But, you know, I'm kind of, a man of letters, if you will, but I'm not right. really a novelist guy or a poetry guy. I use music to write the lyrics. And I see the lyrics and the music as being a marriage. I never take one or the other separately, if that makes any sense. I see it as has to be of a piece. And it, to me, it has to be simple, you know?
Right. Right.
And I think that's why I get so many of those more direct lyrics, is because I like it to, I want the listener to attach to it.
You have some tour dates. The record comes out September 21st, and you're on the road through most of October, a little bit into November, and finishing out. I'm sure there are more dates coming. I'm sure you're always busy. You're one of these guys. What's next? I mean, besides this record and touring this record, have you already started work on the next one? Are you going to take a break? You need to play these songs for a while before you can start on something new?
I got to be honest, man. I've been playing these songs live for probably about 4 years, some of them, because of how all this timing worked out. You know, I've got another album written. We've been talking about maybe going in the studio in December, but there's a lot of, you know, exciting stuff coming our way next year. You know, what I'm trying to do right now is a lot bigger than just being an artist out there and doing the traditional touring. I mean, you can't really do it anymore, to be honest with you, buddy. It's not sustainable.
Right.
You can't raise a family being an artist like this anymore. There's just, without any income from record sales and barely any from publishing and royalties, you got to be on the road all the time. And, you know, I've got two kids and a wife that I love very much. And, it's going to be hard for me to, you know, pound the pavement, especially with the diminishing returns. So I've been looking at a lot of different, options for the future. You know, I really want to get into, I think, what part of the sentiment behind Saving Grace is about protecting, what I call real rock and roll, you know, which has blues and rhythm and blues and jazz and country and bluegrass and all that stuff sewn into it. It's a beautiful fusion of all the great American music. So I've always taught a lot, and I'm looking to do, you know, more educational things, more mentorships, more producing, more writing. I've been doing a lot of writing with artists lately. Some you would know well, some you don't know, but you know, I'm really looking to get into that role as well, just because I think that, you know, rock and roll is really going the way of classical and jazz, right? So classical, you know, it was a vital art form, and then it wasn't. And people like Leonard Bernstein and, you know, and Lincoln Center and all these things, they revived it. Juilliard, you know, they revived the music as a educational, performance, creative, integrated thing. Then the same thing happened with jazz, and now you have Wynton Marsalis of jazz at Lincoln Center.
Right.
So I'm looking to establish something like that for the music I love, which is rock and roll, blues, soul, country, bluegrass, you know, all the other stuff that doesn't get included in that. And really, there's nothing out there like that right now. I mean, Berkeley is the closest thing, you know, so there's a lot of different things, you know, on the horizon for next year, and I'm just looking to integrate all of it with record making, you know.
Well, continued success and continued following your passions. I mean, Saving Grace is a great record, and I'm so glad we have it, and it really does make a beautiful tribute to Greg with everything a good man needs, and just the sentiment behind the record and playing with all these guys who, you know. As you said earlier, may not be, unfortunately, around for much longer. So thanks so much for the record and for taking the time today, man. Really, we really appreciate it.
It's always a blast talking to you, man. Thanks for having me.
Scott Sherrard is attempting to do something that is beyond noble and should be applauded. While our larger population continues to consume throwaway content, he is sticking to the classics, ensuring that they endure. He isn't only doing this on his own, he is teaching future generations about the very music that has endured and is timeless. For more on Scott's work, visit scottsherard.com and make sure you get your ears on Saving Grace and see Scott at one of his various dates. As we leave you, have a listen to this soon-to-be classic, Angeline.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. Subscribe to our newsletter today at thesoundpodcast.com/subscribe. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. The Sound Podcast is part of the Osiris Network. For more, visit osirispod.com. Thanks for listening. Osiris.